those of us in northern Utah had seen the weather forecast of high winds for Tuesday, but I'm not sure any of us expected what happened. One official said it was the worst storm of its kind in living memory around here. Hurricane force wind is what people were calling it, which seemed like hyperbole at the time, but literally, there were gusts clocked at 99 miles per hour. That's hurricane velocity. Residents from Salt Lake, Davis, and Weber counties paced and fretted from inside, bracing themselves and wincing when a flurry would hit. And then, at some point early on, the trees started to fall. Hundreds, thousands. Someone's doing the tally, I guess. But when the coast was clear and people ventured out to survey the damage, you could see it for yourself. Downed trees were everywhere. Grand, stately trees strewn around like corpses on a battlefield. And it seems like an apt metaphor because when you were talking with your neighbors this week about the wind, hasn't it been like someone close to you died? Producer Tim Slover went to Liberty Park, which got hit pretty hard on Tuesday. There he met up with Katie Clifford, who lives nearby.
Hey, Katie. I'm good. I'm already recording. Is that okay? I'm already recording. Is that okay?
I guess it is.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Cool. Well, thanks for doing this.
Of course. It's so funny. I was here earlier today wandering and crying. So.
Oh, my God. Well.
Getting a little emotional.
I was thinking we could go kind of over to that big old downed tree
that
and just see what it's like.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds good. Yesterday tried to stay away from here, but I had driven by and seen kind of how everything looked, and so I wanted to come over and just get like a real sense of the damage. And it was way sadder in person than even the pictures that I'd seen. It felt like I was in a forest instead of a park, and not in a good way.
Look at this one right here, this huge spruce or evergreen. It must be what, like,
yeah. And it's interesting that we're by this tree because I have a good friend who we used to, pre-COVID times, walk around the park once a week. So now we sit in the park once a week, and this is the tree we meet at. And it's not going to be the tree we meet at anymore.
Meet at this tree?
We meet at this tree. This, because the parking's right there. And, we just come sit under this tree and go over our week, and it's been like a normal thing to do-ish all summer, and now there's this.
Wow.
That will make it feel very marked, you know?
Yeah.
So when COVID started, I started running on the outside of the park as the sort of normal activity. And this park, I feel like, has felt like a friend.
Yeah.
And now it just feels like that poor friend got real, real ravaged.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it looks like a battle has happened.
It looks like a battle has happened. And I think the crazy part about the trees, I guess, is everything that's happened this year, you've been able to sort of be like, okay, we'll get summer again, we'll have spring again, like things will get normal again. And today when I saw these trees, it was like, well, we won't get those trees back.
Yeah.
Like those trees are gone.
Should we sit on it? Then kind of we can know it again.
Can we do that?
We can make it into sort of a bench, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, tree.
For me, sitting on a tree like this, I don't know, it doesn't feel like disrespectful. It just feels like I want to get back to know it again a little bit.
It does not feel disrespectful at all. I think, in fact, these trees would be happy to know we're kind of saying goodbye to them.
Mm-hmm.
brother and I climbed trees as kids. Always, we loved. We had big apple trees and stuff in our yards, and every house we moved to, there was always a tree that we loved to climb. So they've just always, since I was a little kid, been that sort of symbol of beauty and safety and home.
A refuge.
Yeah, totally. Everything else has felt like ambiguous loss. Like you might get it back, you might not. It's hard to sort out. And these trees, I feel like I felt pretty okay, like optimistic and trying to like be healthy about all of this. And these trees, I just lost it. They've been here forever. And they're such a part of this city. And what people love about Salt Lake is our old trees in this neighborhood, and for them to get lost just felt like insult to injury in a year that is so weird. Yeah. To then just lose these trees was like, oh, for crying out loud. Like, can we have one thing that doesn't get touched by this? And apparently we cannot even have giant trees. I think the permanence of the loss drove home a lot of what's been happening this year in a way that's sort of forced me to look at it dead on. I think especially if you're an optimist, you can hide sometimes in being an optimist. And today and yesterday I felt like, okay, this is a tragedy and that's okay. And it's okay to cry about it, and it's okay to be really disappointed. And I don't think I've let myself be really disappointed yet. And you're okay to do that. So I feel like in some ways, sort of like a healing experience of the permanence of this loss
has helped you feel that disappointment.
Yeah. Given permission to just say, okay, I'm really sad about this.
About the year and...
about everything. And the trees were sort of a catalyst for processing feelings that maybe I haven't wanted to confront yet. But the trees, who've always been here and always been comfort and sacred, are doing their job again. They are beautiful symbols, and they always have been. And now even these broken, sad ones are symbols of a loss that we can come back from.
Where do you find refuge now?
Honestly, I think it's still going to be this park. I think what will be the thing that sort of makes it okay is to still come here and to find new parts of the park that are important. This tree was a meaningful tree, but maybe there's another tree that my friend and I sit under and talk about things. I do think coming back to the places that have brought you comfort and trying to adapt the way you feel about them is what next year's maybe going to be all about, is getting back so many of the things we lost and seeing them through different eyes, appreciating them in a different way. I will never look at this park the same way again. It's always going to feel like now a place that has been through something, but it's going to be okay. It's going to go on.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So that's what we're going to talk about today, about the trees, the way we're feeling about losing so many on Tuesday, how we connect with them, how they remind us that we live in an ecosystem no matter how tame we've tried to make it, and how a downed tree can give you a glimpse of your own mortality. Luckily for us, we have one of the world's experts on trees nearby. Nalini Nadkarni is an ecologist and professor of biology at the University of Utah. So I guess the first thing I have to say I wanted to know, and I've been thinking about this today, as a tree expert, as really one of the great tree experts in the world, what has it been like for you to walk around the neighborhood or the park nearby, which I imagine you've done, mm-hmm. and see those trees uprooted, just like your reaction to them as an expert, as someone who knows them?
Well, it's hard to separate out, you know, the knowing of trees intellectually and academically, which I've spent my career on, with my own personal feelings about trees and the emotions they evoke in me. They're sort of intertwined. I guess my first reaction was like, oh my gosh, you know, how could this happen so suddenly overnight? Our tree friends and neighbors, are many of them are on the ground. You know, many of them have lost huge parts of their crowns. And so I guess my first reaction was one of disbelief that this could have happened really before the end of the summer. But there they were. And so that was the very first one. And the second one was really, I guess, a more intellectual, scientific one, which is, oh, but this goes on all the time in the lives of trees and in the world of forests, that forests are dynamic, even though we think of trees as stable, as they're being there for centuries or for generations, that these kinds of disturbances are felt by trees throughout many of their lifetimes. And that in some ways I have to tell myself not to let my emotions overcome me, but instead to say, ah, this is yet one more piece of the amazing, complex, fascinating parts of the life cycle of our arboreal neighbors.
So for some of us who don't quite have that perspective, at least not yet, and we're hoping to get it from you today, but
yeah.
But there is something like grief that a lot of us have been feeling about those trees. Do you sense that, I'm guessing, from others?
Of course I sense that. And I sense it in myself. I sense it in my neighbors. You know, when we emerged on the morning of, you know, after the windstorm, we were all kind of staggering around the avenues where I live, our neighborhood, and really recounting stories and memories of the individuals that had been vertical just the night before, and now we're lying horizontal crossing the little streets of our neighborhood. And there was real grief, and there is real grief, and I think that grief is not something to be taken lightly. I think I felt it more for individual trees that I know, you know, trees that I've walked by every day on my way to work, that, oh, there's my maple, or there's that sycamore that I notice, or there's that apple tree that I pick up an apple from occasionally. So there's this sort of personal connection to individual trees that I think when we see them crushed or broken or lost limbs, that we feel even more than the general world of trees. And I think I was witnessing that morning with my neighbors. And I felt that grief. I definitely did.
Yeah. So it's also, it seems like this is something you've said, is that it's making us, I guess, more connected to this reality of what trees experience every day. Say a little bit more about that. You talk about this dynamic experience of being a tree.
Right. Well, I think, you know, we think of, because our generation times are much shorter than those of trees, you know, we live to maybe 80 years old, but most of our street trees here can be as old as 200 years. So they surpass us in age. And so I think we look to them as sort of markers of time, of longer time than ours. And yet we know very well when we see a tree that is fallen, we look at its rings, that in fact trees encounter disturbances of many kinds, and very often their lives do result from a windstorm like this, or a forest fire, or some other accident of nature that brings them down. And I think that's just like the way we have to kind of grapple with the finite lifetimes of ourselves as humans, that, you know, there's a time to be born and live and be active, and a time to age and be old, and then finally a time when we stop living.
Yeah.
And I think because of the juxtaposition of these different generation times, we're more sort of shocked and taken aback when we see the death of these trees. It somehow doesn't figure in how we look at them.
Yeah. You know, one of the issues that has come up in the, at least in the immediate aftermath, is, and whether we like this or not, that wind is part of a natural process. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you about that. What does wind, I'm not sure this is the way to put it, but what does wind do for trees?
Well, wind, I don't know if it does anything for them, but it certainly has an effect on them.
Sure.
One thing that constant wind does, you know, is imbue trees with more strength. You know, for example, I work in Costa Rica in a cloud forest with which has wind just blowing through it almost constantly, the trade winds. And those trees are incredibly strong in terms of imbuing their, they have this sort of structural strength that has been, that is part of their lives that they've had to invest in if they're going to stand up against it. Whereas here in Salt Lake City, you know, windstorms are quite infrequent and they tend to occur during the fall and the winter after the leaves have fallen off of these trees.
Yeah.
So one idea that I had when I was looking around at how many trees had fallen on, you know, and here we are in mid-September when trees are fully, have their foliage on, you know, fully clothed, sort of like having all their sails up on a sailing boat, is that they probably caught more wind than they're used to at this time of the year than, say, if this windstorm had occurred when it normally should during the late fall or the winter. And in fact, you can see some trees that are dead that are still standing, you know, a big cottonwood tree that has lost its leaves because it's dead standing. And right next to it is this really healthy looking tree that has fallen over because those leaves caught these huge gusts of winds out of season. And so I think that was kind of an interesting thing to observe, was what happens when a tree encounters out of season wind. And this was the consequence.
You know, a lot of us have been talking about, as we're walking around our own neighborhoods, looking at all the branches and that what seemed like dead wood. Like I was thinking, oh, the wind is cleaning out the dead wind. There is some sort of natural process in that, I wondered.
Absolutely. And what I thought was, what I've been really, really interested in is how different species of trees respond to this agent of disturbance, this wind. So, for example, sycamore trees, you've probably seen, well, here's my calculation, about, I would say 72% of the sticks and leaves that I saw on the ground were from sycamore trees, at least in my neighborhood. Sycamore trees are these very large trees. They have sort of mottled bark and they have fruits that look like sort of like green ping pong balls when you see them on the forest, on the floor, on the ground. And those trees tend not to fall, but to sort of get their very brittle branches blown off in little pieces. So lots and lots of little branches fell off the sycamores, whereas other trees in the same location, like the linden trees, they tipped right over.
Yeah.
So I think that shows us, I mean, kind of metaphorically even, that different organisms, different people, different tree species respond to these pressures in different ways. The sycamore by shedding pieces of itself rather than falling over, and linden trees, unfortunately, not being able to do that and the entire sacrifice.
It's interesting you made this interesting connection to the question of how it is that some people survive COVID and how some people don't. Say something about that, because you're making a connection here, which I think
it is interesting. I think of my mom. My mom is 97 years old. She's in an assisted living center in Charlottesville, Virginia. She remains cheerful throughout her isolation. She's isolated in her own tree, in her own room right now, because they can't sort of circulate within the center. And she's still, you know, whenever I talk to her on the phone or get a postcard from her, she sounds cheery and happy to be looking out the window at people walking by. And yet, on the other hand, I know some of the graduate students here in the biology department and at the university are really, really having a difficult time dealing with their world of missed experiments and no access to the lab and what's going to happen with their dissertation, and are having a very, very difficult time being isolated and not being able to do the work. So I think just as these different tree species respond differentially to this pressure, this disturbance of wind that happened. So I think that's also true of how we humans might respond in different ways to disturbances and pressures in our environment, and how we might, you know, look to others, even my 97-year-old mom, to gain wisdom about how do you deal with a disturbance that comes through unbidden from other sources.
You know, professors, those who may not be familiar with your work should know that something like what happened on Tuesday fits into this cycle of that you've been writing about and thinking about for some time: shock, disturbance, recovery. Talk a little bit about that cycle and the way you think about it. We've talked about this before, but I wanted to get your sense in the context of this moment.
Well, I think that disturbance, from what I've learned, and I think that probably for me, the biggest disturbance in my life has been falling out of a tree, actually, 5 years ago, 50 feet, and breaking all kinds of bones and having to take a year really to recover. That disturbance, number one, made me aware of how fortunate I have been in my life to have the resources and the capacity I do to get out into nature, to carry out research, to teach students, things that I just really love. And when that opportunity felt like it was snatched from me by this disturbance, I have come to appreciate the gifts that I have been given, the gifts that I've accrued over my time, much more so than if that disturbance had never happened. And I think by analogy, that's what's happened with me during the last couple of days in watching all of these trees fall down. I mean, I've always been kind of bitter about how little people are aware of the fantastic nature of trees, you know, in their surroundings. I've always wanted to make people more aware and appreciate better what trees do for humans and what they are as a magnificent organisms and pieces of nature. And I think that trees have been these kinds of like silent neighbors, you know, like a quiet neighbor you never notice. And then with this windstorm, you know, trees have taken center stage. They have fallen on our cars and our roofs, and they've blocked our streets, and they've taken away our electric power. And suddenly we're realizing, like, wow, trees are really important in our lives. People are, you know, trees are here in my neighborhood. And so I think one of the, what I would have to say, despite the pain and this mourning and the sorrow of these tree falls, is that I think it has made us more aware of our urban forests. It has made us more aware that we walk by these trees every day, how tall and strong they are, and yet at the same time, how vulnerable they are to disturbances that we humans might have something to do with. Mm. And so just as that fall from the tree made me more aware and grateful for the gifts that I have, I think that this windstorm could make us more aware of the gifts that trees bring us. And in addition, I think, this windstorm has let us see trees in different ways. Like suddenly they aren't these tall vertical poles, you know, they're like when they're on the ground, you can actually walk up their trunks. That's what I did today, this morning, in one of the trees that fell over in the cemetery in the avenues. And you know, you look at their root wads and you go, holy moly, like what is going on? This huge tree has this really small amount of roots that, you know, that were snapped up. Yeah. So it just gives us this a way to look at trees with more gratitude and awareness, but also just to see trees from a different perspective than what we normally do.
I also think one of the things that was kind of disorienting for me or in some of us that I've talked to is that you figure that this kind of destruction, this sort of natural sort of disturbance, is something that happens in a forest, not in a neighborhood. Like, and this is something you've said, like we think of urban environments as being more stable somehow or more predictable, but because they're in a park strip, you know, because they're in a cemetery, but that's not the case. And I think that's another really interesting reminder.
I agree with you, Doug. I think that's a really insightful thought. You know, humans create the urban environment. And yet the objects of nature that are within the urban environment, whether it's earthworms in the soil or trees in the cemetery, are subject to the disturbances, the forces of nature, just as they are out there in the wild, up there in the Wasatch or out in the Ochre Mountains. And in fact, sometimes being a tree in an urban environment can actually make a tree more vulnerable to some of these disturbances. Like, you know, we water our trees here in Salt Lake City, as we do in many urban areas. And that makes these, the root systems of trees be quite shallow. They don't actually, they're not forced to keep growing down deeper and deeper and deeper until they hit groundwater. And so some of these tip ups that you've seen of the trees that have fallen over, those trees have really shallow root system and systems. And I've been wondering, you know, whether this, you know, irrigating them at the surface have actually made them more vulnerable to being tipped over than what we might see of trees in the wild that are forced to dig their roots down so deeply that it actually gives them more structural support. So yes, you're right. The urban environment doesn't make the denizens of our urban environments not subject to the forces of nature. In fact, we may be even more vulnerable than what we might encounter in the wild.
Why do we feel a kinship with trees, do you think? I mean, they're beautiful for sure. They provide, you know, shelter and shade, but is that it, as far as you can tell? Is there something more abstract going on in terms of the way we love them?
Yeah, you know, I think that is such a good question. And I ask that of myself because I love trees so much and I identify with them in certain ways. And in certain ways we can, you know, we both have crowns, we both have limbs, we both have trunks. And so there's something very human, I think, when we look at a tree and see it as an individual. And so I think that might be part of it. I think also, you know, we evolved in trees. We climbed trees for safety when we were evolving in the savannas of Africa. And there's a lot of research that has been conducted to let us know that humans have this sense of safety, of belonging, of this is where I belong when we're actually up in a tree. But, you know, I was on a solo backpack just a couple weeks ago up in the Pacific Northwest, just delving into the forest there. And I remember lying beneath a tree, looking up at it and thinking, yeah, I really want to be a tree. I really want to be like a tree. I've aspired to that for my entire life. But as I looked at the tree, I realized, actually, I'm not like a tree. I'm not silent. I'm not stuck in one place the way trees are. I can't survive without movement, without moving from one place to another to get the things I need. I'm not modular like a tree. You know, trees can lose their limbs, as we saw this week, and they still survive, you know, because they're built that way. You know, if we had human limbs strewn all over the streets of the avenues, you know, it would be a really horrible, gruesome sight. But trees can do that. They can shed parts of themselves. And so I was sort of left with the question after that hike about what is my kinship to trees? Am I tree-like as I wish I were, or am I a human? And can I accept that I am not tree-like, but that I can still appreciate how these amazing organisms have evolved to survive for centuries, still be subject to agents of disturbance, but persist through time. So I guess I could leave that as an open question for each person to answer for him or herself.
You mentioned to us earlier that you came across one of the fallen trees from Tuesday, and it made you think about your own mortality, the idea of when it is that you may, as you put it, fall over. Say something about that for me, will you?
Yeah. Well, I think, again, that this concept of time, of longer time than my time, is what trees are often telling me when I walk by them. I think that trees measure time. And actually, this is a great time to see how trees measure time, because there's so many pieces of trunks that have been cut by arborists. So you can actually just scoot around them and look at the rings that they accumulate. There's this wonderful poem by Hermann Hesse, an essay actually, and I'll read a little piece of it if you don't mind.
Please.
He wrote, "When a tree is cut down and reveals its naked death wound to the sun, one can read its whole history in the luminous inscribed disc of its trunk, in the rings of its years, its scars, all the struggle, all the suffering, all the sickness, all the happiness and prosperity stand truly written. The narrow years and the luxurious years, the attacks withstood, the storms endured. And every young farm boy knows that the hardest and noblest wood has the narrowest rings, that high on the mountains and in continuing danger, the most indestructible, the strongest, the ideal trees grow. And I love this essay because it tells me about my life. It tells me that if I had rings like a tree, that I would have, somebody could read in my rings the hard years and the easy years, the times when I've had struggles, the times when I bloomed fully. And I love the fact that trees have a record of that, that we can go and recreate by simply looking at a cross section of their trunk. And it reminds me that everything passes. And I guess what I would like to think about is, you know, how can I make my tree rings matter as much as possible? How can they contribute to, I don't know, whatever community that I might be living in or working in, just as trees do, sort of unconsciously, they contribute to our communities as well.
Professor Nalini Nadkarni, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Doug. Thanks.
That's Nalini Nadkarni. She's an ecologist and professor of biology at the University of Utah. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Using your smart speaker, starting your day with NPR Utah has never been easier. All you have to do is tell it to play KUER, and we'll be there throughout your morning with news and the latest Utah stories.
Now, the state of Utah has made an important move in this controversial issue. It's the first state in the country to protect.
That's KUER on your smart speaker. Just tell it to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the trees we all lost on Tuesday, because a lot of us are feeling something approaching grief as we survey the damage. So what do we lose when we lose trees? It's a conversation we've been having about natural patterns, but also the emotional costs when those big giants come crashing down. Joining us now on the program is Matthew LaPlante. He's a journalist and associate professor of journalism and communication at Utah State University. He's covered and has his own interest in trees. His latest book is called Superlative, The Biology of Extremes, where he writes about this massive stand of aspen trees in south central Utah, I'm sure you've heard about, known as Pando, one of the largest organisms on the planet. Matthew LaPlante, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
So I guess we should begin with your own reaction. Give me, as someone who's interested in organisms and biology and writing about this from the sort of rational side, but also the emotional part of it, you're in the middle of the windstorm. How are you thinking about what all of this is? You know, what's your reaction to all of that?
Well, I live just a stone's throw, literal stone's throw from Liberty Park in Salt Lake City. And so, of course, as soon as we could after the storm, we went on a walk there. And, you know, the results of this storm were like, you know, nothing I had seen in that park. You know, every now and then we have a windstorm that brings down a tree or two or a large branch. And there's a lot of old cottonwoods there, and we kind of expect those to go.
Yeah.
You know, the city foresters take care of them and try to keep them up as long as possible. But just the extent of this storm and the damage and the loss was, you know, it was really, it was very sad.
Yeah. One of the director of the Urban Forestry Department talked about it being one of those one of the biggest storms in living memory. Like this, something like this. I mean, of course, there was 2011 that was really bad. There was the tornado in 1999, but this just seemed as bad as anything, and it came in a terrible year.
Yeah.
Are you putting it in that context too? Because I think a lot of us are like, oh, this sucks. This
2020.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's everybody's immediate response to anything right now. And, you know, it's every time something new. I mean, we had the earthquake earlier this year, and of course the pandemic, and the fires from California and Oregon are blowing their smoke in, and now we have fires of our own here in Utah. And it just seems like it's one thing after the next. And, you know, the really interesting thing about this storm, and I think the thing that I'm still trying to sort of grapple with is, you know, I've seen lots of different, because of my job, I've seen lots of different kinds of disasters, both man-made disasters and natural disasters. And they always, you know, like when they do this much damage, they also come with a very great loss of human life, usually, right? Like those things seem to coincide. And we lost one person, and I don't want to belittle that tragedy, but given the way our city looks right now, the fact that most of us came out of this okay, unscathed, really, I guess it gives us a better opportunity to really focus on this relationship that we have with the trees, which are the most visceral result of the damage.
Yeah. Put a pin in that. I want to come back to that, actually. I want you to respond to something that a listener wrote to us on Twitter. Emily mentions that a windstorm that uproots trees changes the landscape, makes it different than it was before. But she says, we haven't fundamentally lost anything. And here's the point she makes. Trees, she says, do not have consciousness. And I think because of popular culture, we're projecting our own insecurities about death and mortality on trees. A tree's life, she writes, is not just measured by the time it's rooted firmly in the ground. It continues to have an ecological function after death. So what do you make of that response? I think it's so smart and rational. Like, we really, come on, guys. Are we overreacting, I guess, to it all?
I don't think we're overreacting. I don't think we're over dramatizing. We have relationships with trees. Now, Emily's exactly right. And by the way, you should get her on her show right away.
We've had her on the show, by the way. Emily's been on the show. Yeah, she's great.
Perfect. All right. So she's absolutely right. Like, these trees will continue to function and to give and to be a part of our environment and our ecology for a very, very long time to come. They're not really even dead yet. But our relationship with these organisms is real. And it is deep, and I think it's okay. I think it's completely okay to both acknowledge that this is what trees do and that these trees will continue to serve a function, and also acknowledge that we feel sadness. For whatever reason, we feel heartsick over what has happened.
Yeah. So one of the things I was trying to get at with Dr. Ned Carney earlier was the kinship, how we understand and explain the kinship. I wanted to get your sense of all of this. One of the things that Nalini mentioned is that we have a deep connection to trees because we evolved as a species in the comfort of trees. And you yourself, I know, did your share of climbing in the trees when you were a kid. So take that on. What do you think explains our connection to trees?
Well, I think it goes even deeper than that. And I think it's a connection that if we feel this connection with trees, I hope that we reflect on that and think about that, because trees are eukaryotic species just like we are. We evolved from a common ancestor. And so we didn't just evolve in trees. We evolved alongside of trees and as cousins to trees. And I'm sure that could be overplayed, right? We're all sisters and brothers to every living organism in this planet and whatever. But I think that we do have more than just sort of a passing relationship to these things. And it certainly marked my life at a lot of points of my life. Trees have been very meaningful. I met my best friend, my best childhood friend. We met in a hollowed out redwood in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and found out in that redwood that actually we lived 100 miles away, but we both lived within a few miles of each other, 100 miles away. And we became deep friends. And then our entire childhood was spent climbing trees. That's where we spent the majority of our time, in my parents' backyard, which is relatively large backyard for a suburban home. And, you know, we climbed every single one of those trees. We make relationships in trees. And
we carve our names into trees, even though maybe we shouldn't, but
Well, I mean we build structures in trees, and then trees create the structures that we live in. And they house us.
I think that connection to I've heard of a few people who we've been asking for people to give us their sense of what's going on, you know, their reaction to the trees and stuff like that. And one of the things we're hearing a lot about is, or we've heard a bit anyway, is from people who've said, for some reason it's different. These trees that have fallen down in a city are different from when you see a tree in nature, in a forest that's fallen, it seems, oh, that makes sense. It's part of a natural process. But when you see it in a city, maybe because we have a relationship with this tree, right? We make connection to individual. This is something you've said. We make a connection to individual trees, and that makes it somehow our reaction just different, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're part of our daily life. When we see something in the forest, most of us, when we see something in the forest, it's the one time we'll ever see it there. Or maybe we went on a camping trip, you know, 20 years ago, and then we return and we see the forest has changed a little bit. And that does very much feel like the thing that it's supposed to do. But also, we don't have a daily relationship with that, right? I don't think it's a whole lot different, honestly, because it's part of our landscape, because it's part of our urban life. You know, when we see buildings that used to be bars that we met friends in that are torn down, or we see an old school that we used to go to school in, and it's been renovated, and now it's apartment complex or something. We feel that loss also because it's part of our daily life. And these trees, they are incredibly useful markers for our journeys across the city, just as much as, you know, maybe a monument might be or an old building might be. You know, we pass a tree and we know, oh, yeah, that tree is the tree where I turn. Or by that tree, there's a drinking fountain. I know that. Mm-hmm. Or just past that tree, I know where the coffee shop is.
Let me read a few comments. Joya writes this, that when my little tree was watered and the ground had soaked it, huge winds last year knocked it half over. My HOA wanted to destroy it, and I defended my tree against destruction. So what if it's leaning over? It will compensate in time. Besides, who cuts down trees in the desert? This year I have shade because it's still in my yard. Yay for trees, she writes. Matthew, what do you think about that, this reaction of us, like, let's protect these suckers. I know it's imperfect, and we're probably all, or a lot of us are looking at the trees in our yards that are now shorn of leaves or branches, wondering, gosh, it's... I guess it'll take a while for it to come back. I mean, that impermanence, that idea of looking deeper is maybe one of the things we'll learn about all of this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we had a tree in our backyard that was leaning over our garage. And it was really becoming clear that the choice was the garage or the tree. And we chose to take down the tree last year. And it wasn't a beautiful tree. I mean, like in my – like it was just sort of like – there, and it was in an inconvenient spot, and I probably should have taken it down years earlier, but I resisted because I just hated the idea of taking it.
Yeah.
And I think that's good. I mean, goodness, we need more trees, right? Like, I mean, one of the fundamental things that environmentalists say, and which research says could really help us out a lot in the long term, is to plant more trees, is to have more trees. So I think we should feel a little bad, even if the tree is imperfect in whatever way we decide, or an HOA, for goodness sake, decides is a perfect tree. We should feel a little bad, and we should defend our trees from being cut down unnecessarily. And when we lose them, we should think about how we can replace them. And we should think about that soon. And we should think about it before we lose them as well.
Yeah. There's a story that came to my mind about trees that I want, and I know you're familiar with this, and I wanted to mention it to listeners. It's a tree. This is a story that came from Radiolab, and I'll never forget this story. It was reported by the producer, Pat Walters, and it's about this man named Don Curry, who several years ago, when he was this graduate student, he was doing climate change research. He was on this mountain in northern Nevada. And part of the research involved drilling these core samples from these old, into these old trees, these bristlecone trees. And so he's drilling into one tree, and the drill broke off inside the tree. And as Walters reports in the story for Radiolab, it wasn't just any drill. I mean, it was this fancy drill that he had ordered from Sweden. He was desperate to retrieve it to continue his research. And so he goes and talks to the district forest ranger, and he says, look, I got to get this. I can't get this thing out of the tree. And they tell him, just cut it down. You know, they say, it's one tree among dozens of them. Look at all these trees here. Just cut this one down. And so they do. And then they cut some slabs out of the lower part of that tree that they had cut down. And Don Curry gets back to his lab, and he puts the slab on his desk, and he gets a magnifying glass, and he starts counting the rings because they're really small, and it takes him forever. He's counting and he's counting. And in the end, there were 4,844 rings. And at that point, Walters says in the piece, the oldest tree that anyone had found was 4,600 years old. So he had himself found the oldest tree ever and cut it down. So here's an excerpt from Radiolab. You'll hear Walters and retired forest scientist Ron Lahner and the nature writer Michael Cohen.
The world's oldest tree was dead.
It was horrifying. It was like a family tragedy.
People had given these trees names.
There was Buddha and Socrates and
Methuselah.
They called Curry's tree
the Prometheus tree.
And the guy who named that particular tree was so angry that he wrote a magazine article where he called Don Curry a murderer.
All across the country, there's a tremendous uproar.
Saying what?
About killing the world's oldest living organism.
You know this story.
Yeah. Well, I wrote about it in my book.
Yeah.
The guy who wrote that article is a local news editor named Darwin Lambert. And he said, I'll never forget this. He said, losing the tree was like walking home from a beloved patriarch's funeral. I mean, he laid it on.
Yeah, he did.
And Curry felt, by all accounts, and there aren't many accounts, by the way, because Curry gave one interview about this to Nova and never talked about it again to anyone. And in fact, literally ran away from an interview once when somebody tried to ask him about it. Curry felt awful. He dedicated his life to salt flat research, which is about the furthest thing
from
that you can get from trees.
Yeah.
But this hung with him forever. But people were mourning this tree. They were so angry about this tree. And you know, the interesting thing is that the tree, you know, like there's some debate, I think, of whether or not it was indeed actually called Prometheus before it was killed. You know, It has a number now. It's WPN114. That's, you know, it's a scientific sample, and it's in a lab at the University of a slab of it is at a lab at the University of Arizona's tree ring lab.
You've seen it.
Yeah. There's a scientist there named Matt Salzer, and I went down to visit him a few years ago, and he said, "Well, would you like to see the Curry tree?" And I was like, okay, yeah. And I'm thinking we're going to go down to a basement somewhere. And he's in a small office, and he goes over to his shelf and he pulls these, it was like 6 or 7 or 8 chunks of tree from a shelf. And he starts laying them out on his desk like a puzzle. And when it comes together, it's about 6 feet in diameter. And this is a really interesting thing. You expect these bristlecone pines to be really, really big, but they only grow about the width of a fingernail every year. And so a tree that is 5,000 years old is 6 feet from end to end. And you can, you know, I traced my finger over it, and I went to the middle of it. And once you get to the middle where the tree rings begin, you're touching something that began around the same time as the founding of Troy. It's amazing.
Matthew LaPlante, the journalist, associate professor at Utah State University, You should also mention that he is author of his latest book, Superlative. Matthew, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Welcome to our new intern, Ivana Martinez. Thanks to her. And thanks this week to Elaine Clark, KUER's news director. The program produced by Tim Slover and Benjamin Bombard. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.